Thank you. I think it's been made quite clear why I'm here. I am old. And I'd also like to thank Boland for his excellent introduction and the high citations that he managed to show clearly are due to the fact the article has been round for nigh on 40 years, and that's the best way to get lots of citations, is be old. I noticed also my biographical stuff says I've been retired 8 years now. I would just say that my wife is still demanding empirical evidence of this assertion. But thank you for inviting me, and I'm honoured to do this, and I have been around at a lot, not quite all, but at a lot of the MARG events and meeting. 40 years in 40 minutes, quite a challenge. Please accept my apologies for those techniques and people and things that I am not going to mention. Particularly the more recent things I look at are quite selective, and inevitably so. But I'm trying to pick out some things that I think have some lessons for where we're going in the future. Now, as Michael was telling us, this started as a limited initiative with funding for, was it 3 years in the first instance, way back in 1979, and still seems to be here. I think it's worth remembering that the academic study of accounting in the UK essentially emerged out of the LSE. There was a time when I think 6 of the 7 professors of accounting in the UK were all ex-LSE people, which indicates the lead that this institution had at that time. If I go on a little way, business schools in the UK only occurred in the late 1960s. And that was a government initiative and funded London Business School and Manchester Business School. And I had the privilege of being in the first cohort of doctoral students at the Manchester Business School way back in 1969. And I'd come from a career, short career, straight after graduation, working in the then nationalized coal industry, which employed over 1 million people. And that, I think, is one of the relevant features of the past, that there were a relatively small number of pretty big organizations around at that time. But I've talked about academic accounting, I've mentioned business schools, and even in a business school, the connection between practitioners and academics was actually not that great. Attempts were made, but differently in different subjects, and with great difficulty and not a great deal of effect in some cases. But here we are in 2019. MARG seems to have survived 40 years and going strong. I have to ask myself whether it is now an institution, but I'll leave it to my colleagues who specialize in institutional theories to answer that question. And what I'll try to get onto is, okay, that's where we are, so what next? But let me take you back, not just to 1979, I'd like to go right back to the 1960s and 70s. I mean, management accounting at that stage, I think, was pretty rudimentary. Decision-making, I would argue, was the primary focus, and economists would point out that efficient short-term decisions should take account of variable costs, not particularly fixed costs. So they recommended routine variable costing systems, and nobody did that in practice. Variable costing was used for one-off decisions, but it was not used for a variety of quite sensible reasons, I would argue, for just that purpose. As I've said, large hierarchical organizations dominated the UK. There were the public sector nationalized industries, coal, steel, telecom, all of those sorts of things. There were other large private companies, I think of ICI, and I'll call it GlaxoSmithKline, but of course it wasn't called that then, but the three bits were all there, and they were all pretty large in themselves. AstraZeneca, again, not in that form. Airlines were there. Remember BEA and BOAC? But they were nationalized, so perhaps they're public sector. But that was the biggest scene. A small number, often public sector, large hierarchical organizations. And on top of that, just a reminder, no computers, or no personal computers at all. Some of the big organizations had one large IBM or ICL mainframe tucked away in a computer center somewhere cheap in the countryside. Coalboard was in Cannock, which I got to know well. And working in operations research, we used quite heavily the computer with paper tape as the input mechanism. In my time, it rapidly progressed to punched cards. And I discovered accidentally the great advantage of paper tape over punch cards. That when you dropped it, it stayed in order. So that's when I learned to number my punch cards better than I had previously done. And on the output side, output was a rudimentary printer with barely legible text often on inconveniently large sheets of paper. So even if the computer was used to produce management accounting information, which was actually relatively rare, it could only be circulated in this inconvenient form. And by the way, photocopying was pretty rudimentary. Remember those old zinc-coated papers that if you touched them, it gave black smudges? Some of you do, and have been there. If you wanted to do multiple copies of a document to circulate to more than two people, you had to psychosile it. That is, a typist had to type it onto a stencil, which then went through a rotary duplicating machine and produced copies of quite quickly deteriorating legibility as it went through. So maybe not a huge surprise that management accounting was relatively rudimentary. And there was much manual and clerical labour, manual in the industrial and production side in the normal sense, but the clerical labour in an accounting department. Most of these calculations were done with pen and paper by hand, maybe with the addition of a sort of adding machine or facet calculator, if you were lucky, turning the handle and multiplying a couple of numbers together. So quite laborious. My argument really is that it was a different world. And we need to view things that have happened from that period onwards from understanding a little about that starting point. So the emphasis in accounting was, management accounting was cost accounting and mainly decision making. Control, well, perhaps budgetary control. And budgetary control turned out to be a great topic for academic accountants as the years moved on slowly, because it was something almost every large organization had. And they didn't have much else either in the formal management control field. That's the short term. The long term was taken account of. The one widely accepted contribution of economists and accounting economists was discounted cash flow. And there were huge debates as to whether this funny technique was actually an appropriate way of evaluating investments. And articles in the academic literature at the time as to whether it was better than profit or better than return on investment. And a number of teaching examples proliferated where you could show that one project could look better on profit and another on return on investment. And perhaps discounted cash flow was a superior technique. I have an article in 1975, which has not become widely quoted, with the late Clive Emanuel, called The Usefulness of Residual Income. Now, you probably don't even know what residual income is, many of you. If I were to say EVA, perhaps that was its regeneration in about 2000 by Stern Stewart. I only regret that my obvious deficiency of Clive and I in writing this article on residual income was it only had two letters. If only we had invented a three-letter acronym for it, we would have preceded Stern Stewart by about 24 years, become rich and famous at the same time. There were other topics. I mean, cost allocation was of interest, mainly to show that it wasn't very useful if you did it, and it actually was impossible to do in any theoretically justifiable manner. It was Art Thomas, wasn't it, who invented the word, I think, incorrigible. In other words, you couldn't justify it other than on an arbitrary basis. It got over into transfer pricing, because remember, we've got these large, often divisionalised organisations. So if you wanted to compute the profitability of one bit compared to another bit, and they were interdependent in some ways, you had to put a value on the good or service transferred, which became a cost to the division that acquired this resource in that way. And again, the economists are coming through. A two-part tariff was flavour of the year at that time, which separated out the fixed cost variant and the variable cost bit. So if you had to have a unit price, you should only use the variable cost, and you should deal with the fixed cost in some other way, like an annual charge or whatever. So the dominant features were essentially economic analysis and variable costs. Behavioural approaches were beginning to emerge. In this country, more social psychological, indeed in the States at the start, social psychological, we diverged a bit, the US becoming or remaining more psychological, the Europe becoming more sociological or organisation theory based approaches. But that's to come. Contingency theories of management accounting were just rearing their head by about 1972-3-ish. And a landmark was the foundation of the journal Accounting Organizations and Society by the late Anthony Hopwood, which has had a profound effect and goes as a journal from strength to strength. It's my notes, not the... I've talked about decision-making. There was an emerging interest in what is now more routinely called management control. And again, just a reminder, this dates back actually to 1965, when Robert Anthony, a professor of accounting at Harvard, distinguished management control from strategic planning on the one hand, which he ignored because that was a different discipline and organizations probably did it, and it was pretty much a senior management activity, so you took that as given, and operational control on the other, which was dismissed because it was going to be too difficult to tackle, because every organization had different operating measures, partly dependent on the industry that they operated in, and partly due to their enthusiasm for trying to come up with appropriate measures to try and monitor performance. Even by then, there was some success with studies of budgeting. And Anthony Hopwood's contribution there was to focus very much on how the budget was used, not what the technical qualities of it were, they were very similar, but the ways different managers made use of budgetary systems, and came up with the very useful generalization that in an imperfect system, that you should not rigidly adhere to a strict reading, you have a budget, adverse budget variance, that is bad, stop it. could be counterproductive, and managers learn very quickly on how to avoid reporting adverse variances. And even that was where my own interest was sparked when I was working in the National Coal Board, of coming across managers who had incredibly ingenious ways of making it appear on the formal reports that everything was okay, whereas in fact it was the data was not okay, and they had managed to affect this in a variety of interesting and ingenious ways. And that's what sparked my interest actually in going off to Manchester Business School to see if I could get more background in this area. My point is, so far, that is 50 years ago. And it's pretty obvious, I think, that the world has changed since then. My prediction, and I hate predicting the future, the past is so much easier, is that if we've seen this change from then over the last, in fact now 40 years I'm going to be talking about, we might expect there'll be other changes heading down the track towards us, and that management accounting may have to respond, perhaps in some ways similarly to the past, but also perhaps more quickly sometimes than in the past. So we have this well-known gap that was formally identified as such, I think, in the 1980s. There was a lot of talk about the gap between what people did in practice and at the coalface and what academics did in their ivory towers. And it was often quite a tenuous connection. But the costing element began to change a little. ABC appeared, activity-based costing. Now, from some points of view, I think I would argue that activity-based costing was very little different to old-fashioned cost accounting of the 1920s, with a lot of small cost centres and a lot of different allocation bases for allocating different types of cost. I think that would be to undersell it slightly, in that I think the really useful concept from ABC was the idea of a cost driver. In other words, what are we doing that causes us to incur this cost? And do we really want to do that now we can see what the cost being incurred is? But that had quite a degree of success. Activity-based cost management had a brief rise to fame. Too many letters, though. Activity-based management, however, is an oxymoron, isn't it? What do managers do except manage activities? But it had its moment of fame. So all these things were showing some progress. And even cost centres became micro cost centres to distinguish them from big amorphous cost centres with arbitrary allocation techniques to allocate costs to them. Rather surprisingly, you may find, strategic management accounting was the brainchild of Ken Simmons at the London Business School in 1981, the first publication I can trace of that. Nobody took much interest, one has to say, at the time. He complained about that in a variety of ways on a number of occasions in gatherings like this, I think. But it really only became popularized nearly 10 years later, and SEMA took it on board in a move brilliantly captured by Al and Michael here as a technique to release management accounting from the factory floor. Remember, SEMA at that stage was called the Institute of Cost and Works Accountants, which gives you the flavor of how cost accounting, at least, was seen at that time. It then became part of the syllabus of SEMA, and I'm still having difficulty finding what techniques are actually associated with strategic management accounting, but we'll come to that. Kaplan and Norton put the boot in 1987 with a major book by Harvard Business School Press called Relevance Lost, and essentially said management accounting was useless for almost anything it was used for, because the information contained huge amounts of arbitrary allocated costs and gave misleading guidance to managers trying to base decisions on it. Brackets, when they should perhaps have used variable costs, and that was resurrecting that argument in some ways. But of course, what Kaplan and Norton were connected with was indeed the ABC costing system that they'd mentioned earlier. And lo and behold, EVA comes out as a new, interesting new measure. It is residual income in disguise, but now aimed at senior managers. And I think had the most of its success, particularly in the USA, because managers had performance measures, I'm talking top-level managers, had performance measures that were either to do with reported profit or share price, which had a tenuous connection with or almost any other measure. Maybe they used return on investment. And the whole debate on accounting profit or return on investment, whereas the answer lies in the intermediate residual income, now as a performance measure, as EVA, became flavour of, not the decade, but about 3 or 4 years, I think, in the US. But I think what we're seeing here is an increasingly perceived need for doing things a bit better. And I've mentioned what the environment was like earlier. It's changing a bit now. Management Accounting Research was founded by Mike, indeed, in 1990. I think I've got the date right. The journal numbers are very confusing these days. You've had two issues in some years, but I did find an original copy. So I think it was there. And dare I say, perhaps, with a more practical emphasis than accounting organisations and society. Knives can be sharpened for later. This is the era of the balanced scorecard. I noticed Roland criticised Robert Simons for his 1984 requiring a balance between different bits of his four boxes in his picture. Kaplan and Norton predates that by 2 years, and they had a balanced scorecard, also with four boxes, and they don't know where what the balance between these boxes is meant to be. But it's become, went on to be, shall I say, the most popular management accounting, if you take it as a management accounting development, in its history, because there are virtually no organisations of any size that I have discovered who have not, at least at one time, used something that they at least called a balanced scorecard. And given its content is peculiarly minimal, I mean, you have four boxes and you put a few measures in each of the boxes. I exaggerate, but slightly. The interesting bits of it, I think, are this technique made strategy central. And there have been various debates, both in the practical literature and also in the academic literature, if we're doing research studies, how do we measure organisational performance? And the easy answer is, well, a profit, or you know, accounting profit in some way. Conceptually, it's clearly obvious, isn't it, that if you're trying to measure an organisation's performance, you have to evaluate it against what its espoused strategy is. And is it being is it doing what it says it was trying to do, or is it failing to do that? But strategy is, of course, multidimensional. And so it's not just making money, it's doing things that perhaps help you make money further into the future and other valuable activities. Kaplan and Norton and many US people would not approve of me using the term stakeholders. But indeed, the balanced scorecard is the first example of at least two stakeholders appearing in the boxes, namely not only shareholders, but also customers. We haven't seen employees or suppliers or the environmental lobby all appear yet, but they will come. And then the other two boxes are more operational, short-term operational in the box labeled operations, and longer-term strategy in the box labelled innovation. And that's a theme that has already appeared again this morning. And more studies of management control systems are appearing. And the general argument, I think, in later literature, is that management accounting moved to be seen as part of the wider area of management control systems, not to take away its decision-making use, but the attention-directing function becomes more important, and perhaps the performance-evaluating function. If we go to terms that actually date back to 1954, and Herbert Simons, not Robert Simons. Two things happened when study of control systems started to rise. Accounting information, yes, surely there, but also non-financial performance measures of various sorts, the sort of thing that would come on the balance scorecard, and other places. And the initial focus, though, was on in internal control within a large hierarchical organisation. A, there were quite a lot of them around, and B, it gave you easy access as a researcher to a large enough sample to do something statistically useful, and you could have many different units within a large hierarchical organisation doing, if not identical things, quite similar things. But we're beginning in the early 90s to get the glimmer that internal vertical control within an organisation is one thing, but organisations, were increasingly cooperating with other organisations. They always had to, but vertical integration, the guiding philosophy is you should do everything. From, say, in the oil industry, for drilling for oil at one end and then producing it, refining it, and making various oil products at the other. You do the same for steel, and not only steel products, but almost anything made of steel. Some companies tried to be domestic goods producers, and a very highly vertically integrated operation. This is now going out of fashion. And we're beginning to recognise supply chains across multiple organisations owned by different people. And that, again, is still a theme. I think there's a lot more. Henry Decker has a lot to say about this and has said it here quite often, of how that needs to be paid attention to. So we're beginning to see, as 2000 is coming onto the horizon, the decline of the vertically integrated enterprise. Outsourcing is becoming popular. The strategy of sticking to your knitting. Do what you can do well and let other people do the routine stuff that you don't want to specialise in. Even British Airways, that well-known, newly privatised industry by this stage, was not doing its own in-flight catering. Why did it ever do its own in-flight catering, one is tempted to ask. But logically, I mean, if you're running to several hundred airports worldwide, some of them you don't fly to very often, so why would you run a catering operation to supply a daily flight? It's almost driven by logical economics. But they went so far that at Heathrow, they didn't then do their own in-flight catering. It was totally outsourced to a varying level of performance, one has to say. Costs are becoming less variable. Labour costs are not driven solely by the level of production. Makes variable costing useful, but there you go. And they are more fixed. And employment terms and conditions and contracts make employees slightly more of a variable feature than they were, let us say, in the Liverpool docks in 1900. People were employed by the day if the employer wished to employ them, and were unemployed for the rest of that day otherwise. So, things have changed. And other management controls, including more operational performance measures, and cost control becoming more focused on the planning stage, because that's when you could control costs,
rather than the operation stage when they have become largely fixed.
In some ways, I see this as putting Antony back together again, that now we are not just looking at the central internal control, we're spreading it, we're trying to focus that on strategy on the one side and in a lot more operational measures, non-financial performance measures on the other. Another feature of this period was the rise in performance-related pay. This has an interesting history, I find. Go back a little further and say pre the Second World War, many manual workers were paid on piecework. That tended to decline. And in the 60s, this was actually quite rare, I think. Come the turn of the century, performance-related pay is coming back, but not most typically to the lowest level of employee in an organisation, but at middle and higher levels. And it's become almost a rarity that an organisation doesn't have some type of performance-related pay at some, if not more, levels. And that's a very marked change, I think, over really pre-2000 and post-2000. And I've been talking a little bit about the private sector, but the new public management, as it's called, also, a lot of these changes are being picked up by the public sector. I was very encouraged by the talk by on Hitachi this morning, which seemed to be an argument, to my mind anyway, of cost-benefit analysis. And what I find interesting is the very extensive literature on cost-benefit analysis in the public sector. Not very much about it in the private sector. And I think it's one of the... I was looking at these techniques and I was trying to think, well, these are the things that were developed and promoted. What were the things that weren't invented and promoted? And this sort of value for money, cost-benefit analysis approaches, accountants... and management accountants in particular, seem to have had very little to do with. And for good or ill, cost-benefit analysis often tries to put monetary values on benefits. We can argue about that. But accountants seem particularly adept at putting monetary values on almost anything. So I find it a little surprising that this hasn't been looked at. And I think some of the issues that were being raised this morning... it's been mentioned, for example, that much cost-benefit in the health care sector is based, puts a value on a human life, which the answer is actually quite similar across many developed economies and comes out somewhere in the range of £5 to £10 million. But we have bodies in the UK now who authorise the use of drugs in our National Health Service, and they do calculations essentially that imputes a value to a saved human life because of a medical treatment. Now, I don't take much credence on the number, but from an economic point of view, trying to equalize your resources so that if you're going to put incremental resources into any particular area, you should do it with the areas that have an imputed value that's high rather than an imputed value that's low. And so, I think there are some things that can be done with these techniques. Now, I was interested to hear Andrew's call for these in the Hitachi area. So the 2000s, things are changing. Academically, studies now often include the public sector. For some reason, probably because there are a lot of them, schools and hospitals have been particularly prominent in this, even though the outputs of both of those institutions are actually quite difficult to measure in any quantitative terms. It's also been reflected in universities and in our research. I'll come to this a little bit later because I will use this as an example of a particular sort of performance measure that many of you here might be familiar with, and some of the adverse effects that it can have. First degree students have expanded and helped in the later 2000s by the government paying universities by the student rather than any other mechanism. Accounting and business studies have become respectable. Well, vice chancellors have to treat them as respectable, as typically 20 to 30% of their university's income comes from these subjects. So it helps. It helps to be profitable as well as respectable. And the evolution of what was originally called the research assessment exercise, and now it's called the research evaluation framework, I think. Performance measures for academics. Now, we've been talking about creativity earlier. I think academics are supposed to show a degree of creativity, so we might be able to learn some lessons from these approaches, because the measures are not perfect, shall we say. And there were more outlets for academic research, more journals now. There's a journal called Qualitative Research in Accounting, and other journals that quite routinely accept papers using qualitative methodologies, and also more sociologically framed work, which is a feature more of Europe than the USA, and from our point of view, actually less psychological experimental work than typically goes on in the US. But there's still a gap between what academics are theorizing about and what practice is worrying about. And I might argue that there's possibly even less emphasis than there used to be to diminish this gap. And it will come back to the performance measure, would you believe? Now, things are emerging, and I'm not going to dwell too much on these, and some of them may already be flourishing and others might die on the vine. But I've already mentioned horizontal control systems, by which I mean value chains or supply chains, whatever terminology you prefer. The strategic management approach to look outside the organization and look at marketing and customers as well as the internal side. And there are techniques there, I mean customer profitability, competitor profitability. Though I am hard pushed to come up with too much in the way of techniques. It's more a perspective and an approach, in my view. At least think about marketing and your customers, as well as production and your products. I don't know whether uncertainty has been increasing. When you look backwards, it always seems to be less than it appears when you look forwards. But I think there has been some change in emphasis, which means we've got to move away from planning, because if the future's uncertain, how can you plan for it in any detail, towards agility. And indeed, our present political situation seems to be showing a similar movement to quite rapid agility of quite amazing kinds. We'll see where it gets us. There are other areas that are causing interest, various aspects of sustainability. At the one end, yes, accountants are in there, accounting for sustainability initiative, putting a sustainability report within your annual report. That actually was a very clever move by Prince Charles, I think, to say if this is going to be taken seriously, it shouldn't be in a separate, rather large and thick corporate social responsibility report. I want two or four pages in your annual report, no more, preferably two, with the key sustainability indicators, and report these every year, please. And that shows even the most hardened financial analyst that you're showing an interest in some of these things. Risk management has become more formalized. I'm sure there was always risk management, but we're looking at it as a separate area now. In many ways, unfortunately, it seems to have devolved into a box-ticking exercise in many organizations, rather than, can I put it, a learning exercise, that having identified potential sources of risk, it ought to force us to think, what are we doing about it, either to mitigate those risks, to avoid them, or at the end of the day, to insure against them in some way if they actually occur. Globalization is another oxymoron. Clearly it's happening. Change in purchasing habits of consumers, and online obviously is an area of rapid change and growth.
And perhaps the emphasis in marketing now and companies from changing from persuading consumers to buy a product, but to rent a service. And we see it in all sorts of places, from motor cars to videos. Well, that dates me, doesn't it? Even CDs dates me. It's all streamed. And typically you don't buy anything but access to a service. And many companies seem to be trying to develop their marketing to make more of their products into services, the advantage from the company mainly being it gives an income stream over time rather than a one-off. You bought a new car, you're not going to do that again for 5 years. Not quite as developed in the motor car industry. PCP purchasing is the as far as it's got, but you still own the car. I think the interesting area comes when the company owns the capital asset and rents it to you, and so they're bearing the risk of obsolescence. PCP contracts, to an extent, because you have to predict the residual value of a motor car in 4 years' time, which is interesting, and particularly if it was 4 years ago and the car was diesel-engined, the predictions were not usually correct. So, but the leasing company bears that risk. So it changes the risk profile as well as the marketing behaviour. And these are all areas which I think deserve attention from management accounting. But I'm not going to try and predict the future. We'll have to do that ourselves over a considerable period of time. What I want to look at is one or two issues that still seem to be around. They've been around a long time. We know something about them, but they still keep emerging in different forms. I mean, the use of accounting performance measures goes back a long time. Chris Argyris in 52, lovely article, The Impact of Budgets on People, and all the funny things that people do when they're told, this is your budget and you better not exceed it. 20 years later, nearly, Schiff and Nguyen come back with an equally interesting article entitled The Impact of People on Budgets. And as I had been seeing what managers did to their budgets at around that period, I found this particularly enlightening. And then Anthony Hopwood came on with his studies on the what tends to be called now the rigid and flexible use of budgets, either using them rigidly as objective quantitative indicators and not to meet them is bad, to a more flexible and subjective approach of saying, well, given the circumstances you are in, that actually might be quite a good performance because the world around has changed over the budget period. And then I was involved, as Roland has pointed out repeatedly, with contingency theories, and that was just a summary article at the time. But what we know is most measures are inherently imperfect. They don't capture every aspect of what it is you want an employee, a manager, to do. And therefore, subjective judgment, particularly when it comes to evaluating that person's performance, is absolutely essential. Otherwise, it will generate a variety of so-called dysfunctional behavior. And there are countless examples of this, and they come out every day. I was reading the newspaper a month ago when I was thinking about this talk, and there was a little article on a CEO of a hospital trust who was dismissed. And actually, he was dismissed in 2010. It's only become public why he was dismissed now, because he refused to meet the A&E targets set for his hospital A&E department. He said, just because a patient has been sitting here 3 hours and 55 minutes does not justify staff scurrying around trying to get them seen to before the four-hour target, when there are other people coming in down the corridor with far more serious and urgent conditions that need to be dealt with. And he just refused to do that, and this was not taken to very kindly. But you can see the impact on other CEOs of that sort of thing. I'm going to use as my example, because it has certain relevance to a lot of university employees here, academics, the research assessment framework. And I will argue, and some of you will no doubt disagree with me, but that it is actually a reasonable formal measurement system, and it's been iterated a number of times now at about 5 yearly intervals, and has been the worst features have been removed and some better features have been instigated. The main virtue of it, in my view, is it put a heavy reliance on expert judgment. In other words, the research output of a set of academics was judged by a panel of experts looking at their published output and deciding how good they thought it was. Okay, there's a lot of subjective judgment there. I would argue also it has been subverted by senior managers, and I would point the finger most at, stick with business school, shall we, business school deans and vice chancellors. Why? Well, these people rightly are trying to manage outcomes. They know their institutions will be judged on the results of this exercise. How do they assess the quality of the research being done in their departments? Even a dean of a business school, how many subjects are there in a business school? From the softer behavioural to the harder quantitative, no one can be expert in all of those areas. You don't really want to farm this out to surrogate panels or expert advisors from somewhere else, but neither do you want your internal departments to self-evaluate themselves, because that might be biased. So they've got a problem. And what they tend to use is a surrogate measure. And the Association of Business School Deans, called the ABS, the Association of Business Schools, it's a trade union for deans, effectively, has come up with a list and says if you publish an article in these journals, you get 4 stars, top rating. These journals are less good, 3, 2, 1, not even worth a star on the quality rating that is used. The underlying assumption is that the quality of a particular article in a journal is effectively measured by the quality of the journal in which it is published. That may not sound like too bad an assumption, but I have some data. There was a further deficiency in the past, for very complicated reasons. A department didn't have to put all its staff in to be assessed. But they weren't funded for those that they didn't put in. So, and funding was dependent on the output of this exercise. But the outcome, I think, is that staff may amend the topics that they choose to research, short-term being preferred to long-term, quick and dirty being preferred to long-term and fun, and it makes it very competitive. And that's interesting because they are trying to encourage interdisciplinary cooperation and all those sorts of things, and the mechanism because of various imperfections. If I cooperate with an academic from a different university and we get a good article in a good journal, we both get credit for it. If I cooperate with a colleague from my own university, it only counts once, not twice. People are not stupid, and they work this out fairly quickly. Some data. Oops, sorry. Should be a title on that. This is difficult to obtain data, like impossible, because the rating that an individual article is given by the assessment panel is not public information, and that there are strict instructions that it should not become public information, because it would be quite invidious. The Australians had experimented with a system about 10 or 15 years ago where it was actually made public information, and it wasn't very successful and caused a lot of problems. However, the expert panel did this for themselves, and the chair and vice chair of that panel, Mike Pidd and Jane Broadbent, published an article in the British Journal of Management with this data in it. They took 1,000 articles of the 12,000 articles their panel was charged with evaluating. Can you imagine? So the economies of cutting down the panel size and all the rest of it don't help here.
But the top line says, well, if looking at the ABS journal list, the first column are articles that the ABS, or the deans looking at the ABS list, would say, well, it's in that journal, it must be a four-star article.
I think we'd all accept that there is some variability within journals. Some articles are better than others, even in the same journal.
The figures in the column are what the ref panel evaluated this data on. And of the 239 articles in ABS top-level journals, only 93 of them, 39%, were given a four-star rating by the panel.
A good number of the rest were given a three-star, but quite a significant percentage, 20%, were given just a two-star. So the panel's judgment was there were some journals that, although they were high on the ABS list, some of the articles published in them were not of that quality.
Now, four-star is a bit of an awkward one to look at because you can't do better on these scales. But even three-star, 500-odd articles, less than 300, just half of them were given three. Some of them got four. So there are four-star articles in three-star journals.
Give us some of us a bit of pleasure to think about.
Of course, it was always mine. But there were an awful lot of two-star there as well. So if you want an imperfect measure, this is actually a prime example that using the surrogate measure is very loosely correlated with the panel judgment measure. So if deans are, for example, choosing whether to hire people or choosing whether to lose people or enter them when they have the choice of entering into the ref, they will use the ABS number, which will give a very variable outcome on the actual number that will be got by the panel. So what a lovely performance measure for all those academics. And we'll look at some of the consequences. I better hurry. There are some generalizations you can make. The more imperfect the measure, the more important it is to use subjective judgment in evaluation. If you want to emphasize the importance of an imperfect measure, attach pay to it. A bonus if you achieve 4 four-star articles, guys. Wouldn't that be good? I don't joke. There are a very small number, but there are some business schools who do exactly that. Can we anticipate this effect? Oh, yes, sure, we can. The precise effect might be difficult to measure. The general effect is obvious. How should we react when it happens? I would say there are two things where we can learn from experience. Number one is before we start, in the systems design stage, and the rough general message is avoid cliff edges. Here's your target. If you achieve it, you'll get a lump sum bonus. So I'm not doing so well at the moment. I'm creeping towards my target, but I don't think I'm going to get there. What do I, as a hard-pressed employee, do? I can't tell you in detail, but I will manipulate the information in whatever ways I can lay my hands on to make sure I just exceed the target. Suppose I'm in a much more comfortable position. Actually, the world, things have been much easier than whoever set the target imagined. And now, after 10 months of the year, I am comfortably into my target achievement area. Beach time, isn't it? Why work any harder? I've got to where I need to be. I'm not saying everybody reacts totally like that, but there is a tendency in that direction. At the other end of the spectrum, when it's happening that way and you notice this is happening, it is pretty obvious indicator that you need to do something. And organizations, in my experience, have been remarkably resistant at changing systems, perhaps justifiably performance-related pay systems, because they're often contractual and take quite a long time to change, but any performance measure. In fact, I think some senior managers see as a sign of their imperfect judgment in the first place for introducing this system, which is a good reason not to. And there's a reference to some of this work in the later things, so I will skip over it. But there are methods that go beyond contingency theory. And also, with a colleague, Monica, who's in the audience here now, we've got an article of looking at the fact that management control systems are actually much more complicated than many of our research designs take into account. So my message is quite simple, really. We need to take the context in which we are doing our management accounting, whether we're researching it or practicing it, actually rather seriously. I mean, practitioners, I think, will think it obvious that organizations are not all the same. Academics need reminding of that on occasion when they aggregate data from apples and oranges. But the components that they contain, okay, you've got performance-related pay. There are 27 different choices you can make within that. Is it a lump sum, or is it a gradual rise? Is it a personal bonus, a group bonus, a company-wide bonus? Is it a big bonus? Is it a small bonus? So just the fact you have performance-related pay doesn't tell you very much, I would argue to Roland. It's precisely which sort of pay you have. And this implies to me that the systems are going to be imperfect, we're going to see signs of it, and the only action we can take, having tried to plan in advance but not got it perfectly right, is to be fairly agile at making adaptations and changes as we go along. So, last point, what about the future? Most of my recommendations, I think, or suggestions apply to both practitioners and academics. We need to know what's going on out there, and we need to have the ability to do appropriate things about it. And I think the skill set of the management accountant is constantly changing, and I would predict will change even more rapidly than it has in the past. We're getting more adept at dealing with non-financial data, for example. This will continue in other ways. The research focus should be wider than accounting. We want to get wider sources of information, not just internal systems generating it. We're providing tools to produce what we might call commercial intelligence. If I think about academics a little bit more, we need to connect academic work and practice more closely and continue to do that, I'm convinced. But academics, I think, in their publication, are paying too much attention to theory. This will attract a deal of comment, no doubt. And what I mean is there is a pronounced tendency in many published articles to seemingly, I'll say at least, to have selected the theory, to have gone and done sub-study because there is a flaw somehow in that, and get some data that shows that. In fact, most articles of that sort have a direct giveaway. They very rarely contradict the theory they started with. I would much prefer things that started with a lesser theory. I'm not saying we go in with blank minds. I know it's impossible. It is helpful to recognize our prejudices, our assumptions, and our implicit theories. But I think we need to recognize that control systems are much more complicated than we commonly assess. Get some data, and then try to look at what the data's saying and theorize about that a little bit at the end of the paper. And say, well, why do we think this has happened? Which would form a basis for other people to go on. I'm going to stop because I did get there.